May it please the court, Mr. Nelson Jones will present argument on behalf of the petitioner.
Now proceed.
You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. This cause originated as an action in trespass to try a title in which petitioners, well, but the predecessor in title of petitioner Houston American Savings was the plaintiff. And the parties who are respondents here were defendants. And one of them, Van Music, was a cross plaintiff as well. I should like to discuss first the two points of error on which this court granted the application for writ of error in the matter of C.C. Devine. Mr. Devine, who is deceased, has filed no response, no reply to the application. There's nothing before this court which attempts to sustain the Court of Civil Appeals' decision insofar as Mr. Devine is concerned. So I shall discuss only briefly these two points of error. They are numbers 9 and 10 in the application for writ of error. Now, the record shows in this case that Mr. Devine executed and delivered to Levoy Music, under whom Houston American holds, executed and delivered to Levoy Music a general warranty deed which contained no lien, an absolute conveyance. And as you will see in under the ninth point of error, the Court of Appeals reversed the judgment non obstante verdicto entered with the trial court with instructions to render judgment for Mr. Devine consistent with the jury verdict. Now this jury verdict, we contend, is totally immaterial and could not form the basis of a judgment for C.C. Devine because as a matter of law, the general warranty deed from Mr. Devine to Levoy Music and wife conveyed to the grantees any interest in the land in controversy then held or later acquired by C.C. Devine. One of the contentions of Mr. Devine is that he, at the time he executed and delivered this deed, didn't own the land. He had, he says, put it in a trust, and that was one of his arguments in the trial court and in the Court of Civil Appeals. Now, that under the doctrine of after-acquired title, I think there's no question that the record in this case shows that the title flowed into Mr. Devine. The people to whom he conveyed it back to him. And that after-acquired title would flow immediately, as I understand the authorities on this subject, into his grantees, who were Mr. and Mrs. Music. Now the tenth point of error points out that one of the principal contentions of Mr. Devine is that it was agreed between him and the grantee, Levoy Music, that he, Devine, would receive $5,000. He testified that he was paid $2,500 at the time he signed the deed and had never gotten the other $2,500. It is the petition of, it is the position of petitioners, and I believe completely sustained by the authorities, that if he'd received nothing, it wouldn't make any difference because an absolute deed, a concluded transaction of this kind, conveyed whatever title Devine then had or later acquired, regardless of the consideration. Now this, one of the authorities which we cite for this proposition is the Commission of Appeals holdings approved, Rogers versus Rogers in 15 Southwest 2nd 1037, is cited on page 32 of the brief. Now, what the court said in that case is summed up in this sentence. When an instrument conforms to the requirements of this statute and purports an executed conveyance of land, the delivery of such instrument has effect as between the parties to vest title in the grantee in all respects the same when there is no consideration for the conveyance as when there is one. So these two, while there are other points which we believe are meritorious in connection with the divine claim, these two on which the court has granted the application with respect to Mr. Divine, 9 and 10, I think are totally destroy both of these contentions. Now, turning to the other parties to the suit, they have no connection with Mr. Divine. Van Music holds her title under a deed from, claims her title, under a deed from her two brothers, Ted Music and Levoy Music, made in the 50s. And this deed conveyed to her an undivided one-third interest. Subsequently, she signed, and she so testified, a deed of trust. And there was a foreclosure under that deed of trust. And Houston American holds title under the foreclosure. Now, it is our position that the burden was squarely upon Van Music to plead as well as prove that there were defects in this foreclosure. There is no pleading in the case suggesting any defects in the foreclosure. And the jury's verdict is unsupported by any pleading. The writ of error with respect to Van Music and also Mr. Keith, who is attorney for Van Music, and joined in a cross-action with her, were the fourth and fifth points in the application for error. Now, the fourth point is that the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the judgment non-obstante entered by the trial court in remanding the case with instructions to render judgment for appellants Van Music and C.C. Divine consistent with the jury verdict, because the verdict is insufficient to form the basis of a judgment for appellants. Now, I won't discuss the findings of the jury with respect to Mr. Divine, because there's no reply here by him, and I think these other two points settle his case anyway. But with respect to the respondent Van Music, it is our position that the Court of Appeals completely misconstrued the case of Jackson versus Uton upon which it rested its decision. That decision, Jackson versus Uton, by this court in 1967, 411 Southwest 2nd 715, does not support the holding of the Court of Civil Appeals. But on the contrary, that case specifically held that the rule applied by the Court of Appeals in the present case is not applicable unless there is a verdict which is sufficient to form the basis of a judgment for the appellant. Now, that's exactly what the court said in Jackson versus Uton, and it referred back to a prior case of Sanders against Harder, where the trial court had rendered a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and the Court of Civil Appeals affirmed, and Harder, the appellee respondent, filed no cross assignment, revealing error committed against him on the trial in the Court of Civil Appeals or in the Supreme Court. And the court said, we reversed the judgments of both the lower courts. Instead of rendering judgment under Rule 324 and LeMaster, we remanded the cause for a new trial because the verdict was insufficient to form the basis of a judgment that Harder, the plaintiff, and the trial court take nothing. Now, the basis for the Court of Civil Appeals decision, as I say, is this Jackson-Newton case, and it's based on the idea that we were required to file cross assignments in order to have any standing in the appellate court. Now, the findings of the jury on which the Court of Civil Appeals held a judgment should be rendered for Van Music were in answer to special issues 13 to 36 inclusive. And these issues are discussed in some detail in this application for writ of error, particularly on pages 22 and 23. Special issues 14, 15, 21, 30, 31, and 34 involve questions of law. Now, that is also presented by, that point is presented by fifth point of error, and fifth point of error was one of the points on which this court granted the application. So we briefed that under the fifth point. I think it's sufficient to say that the decisions of the state simply refute the idea that the jury's answer, which is to a question of law rather than fact, could never form the basis for a judgment. Now, in addition to what I've said about those issues, the jury's answers to issues 13, 16, 17, 18, 19, 35, and 36 are immaterial because the Supreme Court has determined the validity and effect of all the instruments inquired about in those issues, and such determination is conclusive in the present case. That's briefed under sixth point. This is simply the doctrine of stare decisis. This court decided another case involving the same land and decided the validity and effect of certain written instruments which are now under attack, including a judgment of the trial court, the district court in Harris County. The jury's answers to special issues 13, 16, 17, 18, 19, 26, 28, 35, and 36 are immaterial because Van Music is not a party to any of the instruments inquired about and therefore has no standing to sue. That is briefed on the seventh point of error. The jury's answer to special 25 is in direct conflict with judicial admissions, which are made in the trial pleadings of Van Music and Bob Heath, and therefore it's the finding is immaterial and ineffectual. That point is briefed under the eighth point. And there's one other point that should be made here in this connection. There's been a suggestion, at least, in some of the filings by Van Music that certain instruments in this record are charged to be forgeries. Now, that simply isn't correct because there's absolutely no pleading and no proof that the person who signed these instruments purported to act as another in executing the deed or deeds in question. And the authority for that is a case of Nobles against Marcus by this court in 1976, 533 Southwest 2nd 923, which is cited page 23 in the application for error. Now, we say that by reason of the immateriality of the finding, that there could not be any verdict, any judgment based on these findings. Now, under first point of error, the point is made that none of these issues, 13 to 36 inclusive, is supported by any pleading in the case. And a short explanation of that may be in order. The facts are that apparently the respondents recognize that the burden was on them to plead as well as prove some defect in this foreclosure. And so a lengthy pleading in the nature of a cross-action was filed. As you will see from reading the application, the references therein, the trial court sustained special exceptions to all of these allegations and gave an opportunity to Van Music to file another pleading. This was done, and it was an exact copy of the first pleading. Petitioners filed a motion to strike, and the motion was granted. So the case went to trial on a gentleman I plead not guilty by Van Music, and two or three very short statements that were left in the cross section. Statements having to do with the execution of instruments by some of these people. Now, we take the position that there cannot be any materiality in these issues for the reason that they are not pleaded. There is no pleading to support them. And since the burden was on Van Music to plead as well as prove defects in the foreclosure, they've wholly failed to make out any kind of case. I have not discussed each of the points, but I've made some mention of all of them. I believe I have covered what I intended to say in the opening argument.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the court? Mr. Bob Keith will present argument on behalf of the respondent.
Counsel.
Thank you. I, as I understood the granting of the points of error, it was on point 4 and point 5 insofar as it concerned Van Music, and most if not all of my argument will be directed to those two points. As far as point 4 is concerned, Mr. Jones, I thought quite aptly and perhaps brilliantly argued that the verdict insofar as it concerned C.C. Divine might not be sufficient to support a take-nothing judgment in this case. Now, this is very simply a suit in trespass to try title. We have a very simple and straightforward pleading by the petitioner in this case in which they demanded the possession and claimed superior title to the entire tract of ground against Van Music. And there is a not guilty plea, among other things, in the answer which Van Music filed. Now, what Mr. Jones failed to tell the court is that the cross action with its allegations was incorporated as an exhibit in an answer which was filed jointly as to their motion for a summary judgment against her, and also as an amended answer to his original petition. But even if for any reason the court feels that we are here only under a not guilty plea, as I understand the law and the rules, he has a burden of proof as to each and every exhibit he introduces as a muniment of title. Each of those muniments must be perfect in themselves to convey title. They must not leave anything to your imagination or your surmise. And if in fact they in their body do refer to other instruments which have some materiality in passing title, then the person who's doing the abstracting or the person who's responsible to see that title passes must also check on those. Among the muniments of title which Mr. Jones introduced, and incidentally all that he did was to introduce a paper title and rely entirely upon it. He brought no live witnesses. He did nothing except cross-examine the witnesses that brought. And Ted Music, LaVoy Music, Mayan Music, and C.C. Divine are all now deceased. Of course, LaVoy was at the time of this hearing, but in a short space of 2 years, mortality has met most, if not all, the people who participated, either as witnesses or in the trial of the case. The first instrument upon which American Savings based its title was what purported to be a warranty deed from Ted Music, LaVoy Music, and his wife, Mayann, to Van Music. A consideration is recited in that instrument, and it refers back to a deed from one Bartle to Ted and LaVoy Music. That deed retained a vendor's lien and superior title as to the original grantor, Bartle, and to one J.B. Lucas. And the deed was not to become completely effective. Title was not to pass until the vendor's lien and the notes described therein were satisfied. One of the notes was to J.B. Lucas. Now, intentionally or unintentionally, there was an instrument executed by Ted Music, LaVoy Music, and his wife Mayann to J.B. Lucas, who incidentally is their uncle. And whatever that instrument was, and of course it's up to the courts, as I understand it, to construe any contract that's put before them, or any other instrument that's put before them, but you've all been trial lawyers in your past, you've all been trial judges, and it's most difficult to get a construction on any instrument as you're going through the process in the lower court, at least it has been for me. And there's some variance in the opinions that I find at the Court of Appeals level and at this level as to what exactly an instrument means. And of course I think that's what Mr. Nelson has in mind in some of the arguments that he levels at certain of the issues which were submitted by the trial court. And I'll get to that in a little bit. But at any rate, whatever it was that Ted and LaVoy and Mayann Music conveyed to their uncle, as well as the vendor's lien which he had retained, he in turn did convey to his niece, Van Music, at a later point in time. Apparently, and my position is that Ted and Lavoie Music and Mahan Music actually own no interest in the 618.7 acres, which is the subject matter of this dispute. At the time that they did grant, apparently, a one-third interest to Van Music. Later on, it is conceded, and Van Music admits that she did sign a deed of trust to one Craig and Jones, and as it states in its body, it is to secure a note to one Theodore Charles Lucas, who was the son of J.B. Lucas, as trustee of the J.B. Lucas Trust. There were findings which supported the testimony of Ted Music, who was called as an adverse witness by us, in which he denied the execution either by him or that the signature which was affixed to the deed of trust was that of a trustee of the Ted Music Trust, Arch Hollingsworth. In addition, when J.B. Lucas, Van's uncle, conveyed the one-third interest in the 618.7 acres, it was at a time after she had signed the deed of trust and prior to the time that the trustee sale was held. He executed this as a trustee of the Ted Music Trust. Now, one of the ways in which we attempted to defend this suit was that she had superior title by a collateral or a third source. Another was that she was a mortgagee in possession. Now, I know that under the general rule of merger, that once a person is conveyed not only the fee, but also the mortgage interest that you will have the doctrine of merger apply. But strikingly enough, there are a couple of cases which say otherwise. They're cited not in my brief at this time, but in the past, in which if it's quite clear that the mortgagor intended, if the mortgagee intended that there not be a merger, and the party to whom the merger was made did not intend that there be a merger, that the interest can pass separately and apart from the doctrine of merger as to a particular individual. In this case, we find that on exactly the same day, her uncle, J.B. Lucas, assigned whatever interest it was that he had in the original deed from Bartle to Ted and Lavoie Music, that vendor's lien and the underlying interest, the note, to Van Music as well as Lavoie and Mahan Music. At that same date, he also conveyed to Van Music whatever interest it was that he had in the instrument which Ted Lavoie and his wife Mahan had prior in time conveyed to J.B. Lucas. Now, J.B. Lucas clearly had the intention to convey, to first of all, keep them apart and convey them separately. All right, this then is something which was not satisfied by the paper title which had been furnished to the court and the finders of fact, the jury, by Mr. Nelson. We had to find out what happened to that interest. Secondly, Mr. Nelson had to account for the fact that Van Music was claiming from a collateral or a third source superior title in the property. And the third thing that he was required to do under the burden of persuasion, which I think we carried forward, was that Van Music was actually not a mortgagee in possession, and if she were, by his pleadings, he admitted she was in possession, and in an abundance of caution, the jury also found that she was in possession under one of the issues which was submitted by the trial court. He also had to overcome that either by pleading that he was willing to make payment and satisfy that first lien, or secondly, show by some evidence that he'd actually paid it. This then brings us to what I feel is the third critical point in what Mr. Jones needed to prove. He needed to prove that the substitute trustee, B.J. Brown, had the authority and power and ability, present ability, to sell at the trustee's sale, which he has alluded to, the property in question. All right, in the first instance, if, as jury found, Ted and Music and the trustee, his trustee of the Ted Music Trust, had not in fact signed the deed of trust, then the trustee could obviously not sell at least one-third interest in the property. The Van Music could quite rightfully claim under the deed from her uncle of not only his interest, but of any interest that Ted Music Trust had. He, as trustee, could convey that interest to her, separate and apart from the sale. The second thing is that in order to prove the authority and the power of B.J. Brown, the substitute trustee, to in fact sell the property, it was necessary to show not only a valid appointment of trustee by the then holder of the note under the terms of the deed of trust, but actually to show an assignment of that note by the holder, which was Charles Lucas, as trustee of his father's estate, to the TWI Development Company, who purportedly was in existence on May 21st, 1963. Well, it was proved to the satisfaction of the jury, and they so found, that actually it was not until June the 12th that the Secretary of State accepted the papers by which TWI Development Company came into being. Further, there were minutes and records of the meeting, the original meeting, which in which the president of the TWI Development Company was elected on June 12, 1963. Further, the jury found, and in fact you held in a prior opinion, that LaVoy and his wife were the sole owners of TWI Development Company, and perhaps that, as I understand the law, makes that a fact for all time. But again, this jury found the same fact that the court had found in its prior decision. Now, we have a doctrine in the law, as I understand it, that if one of the signers of the note does in fact come in and satisfy it by payment, then that discharges the other note makers from any further liability. And if in fact LaVoy Music had conveyed his interest in this property to his uncle back at the time that I speak of, the instrument which I say was a warranty deed, or was at least and a further assignment to them of whatever interest they had, then he owed Van Music a one-third interest in this property. And under the doctrine which my learned opposition has referred to, at that time that the sale was held, since LaVoy Music in fact was in actuality the owner, Then, under that doctrine, Band Music obtained a one-third interest in the property at that time. This brings me, I believe, to a situation where even if all 24 of the special issues of the jury are set aside as being immaterial, then as a matter of law, Band Music is entitled to have this court or any other court enter a take-nothing judgment against American Savings, and in that situation, of course, by default, it is in her favor. This brings me, I believe, now to a point in the discussion where we should talk about Rule 324. Quite frankly, I wish I had known as much about Rule 324 prior to the time that you granted your writ than I do now, because I feel that the Court of Appeals should have reversed and rendered in our favor. But I was so happy when I got that opinion that instead of going to the books as any prudent lawyer would have done, I thought, well, I'm awful glad that Rule 324 says that if you don't fire cross points, that's it. Because that's it in law. It's like the fellow who started out in the lower court with his lawyer, and they went through a trial, and they filed a motion for a new trial. He liked to be there every time, and so they filed a motion for a new trial. They lost, incidentally, and so they got a new trial. They tried it again, and then the other fellow filed a motion for a new trial. And they said, well, we're going to have to try it again. So this was the third time. He said, well, what do you do now? I said, well, that's all you can try it down here in the lower court. But if we lose, we'll appeal it. Sure enough, they lost it. So they appealed it to the Court of Appeals. Went on up there. They won. And he said, well, what do we do now? I said, well, they'd probably appeal it on up to the Supreme Court. Well, can I go? Yeah, you can come. Then the Supreme Court, and they won there, and he said, well, that's good. Now, what do we do? And he said, well, we have to see what the other side does. So it worked its way on up, finally, to the Supreme Court of the United States. Finally, it turned out that they won, and he said, well, what do we do now? And that's sort of like you are when you're practicing law. It's what do you do next, not what have you done. Well, anyway, as I understand Rule 324, as I understand the cases which were cited by Mr. Nelson, if in fact you have what amounts to a defective jury verdict, if there's something missing, and of course in the harder case there was something missing, because even though the trial court had introduced and submitted issues to the jury wherein it was found that neither of the two had service on them, they had alleged that they had a meritorious defense to the original judgment, and unfortunately that had not been submitted as an issue. And I can see in that situation that surely that the Supreme Court was right in sending it back down for what was a new trial at that point in procedure. Now, that's another thing that I think makes it very difficult for practicing attorneys and certainly for the court, and that is that you have to sort of use your historical perspective in going back to some of these cases and seeing what, if any, application they do have to the present-day practice as it's been chiseled out and carved out. And most, if not all, of those cases, as I pointed out in the supplemental brief, require the case to be remanded back if, in fact, the trial court needed still to do something, or if there had been such error committed that it was prejudicial to the point that it probably was harmful error. Since then, of course, we have the harmless error rule, both in the appellate court and in this court. And my position, first of all, would be that any error that was committed in the submission of any of the issues that they quarrel about, particularly as being conclusions of law, were in fact answered correctly by the jury under the evidence. And that if they were answered correctly, and if the evidence did more or less dictate that this should be a conclusion of law by the trial court, then those conclusions of law will support a take-nothing judgment just the same as if they had actually been findings of fact. The particular language that I wish to call the court's attention to in Rule 324 is that which says that any failure to bring forward by cross points shall vitiate. They must be such cross points as shall vitiate the judgment or the jury verdict. Now, I took the trouble to look up vitiate. I mean, I never really believe I understand the word until I look it up in Black's, if it's there, which it was, fortunately, and also in Webster's. There are several definitions in both of those volumes, but what it means largely is it's an attempt to annul or set aside, destroy, or make invalid. So you've got 24 issues before you, and I think that a combination or some, if not all of them, compel a take-nothing judgment because, for example, on 21, and I've almost digressed to the point of forgetting to discuss part 21 with you because I think it's quite important and I want to be sure that the court understands. 21 had inquired about the power of B.J. Brown, who was a substitute trustee, to sell the property and to give a substitute trustee's deed. Now, it's very seldom that you have palpable fraud on the face of an instrument, but there is palpable fraud on the appointment of substitute trustee. And it's palpable because of the findings of other findings, which I've said, that as to when the TWI Development Company was incorporated, when the president was elected, and yet on the face of the appointment of substitute trustee, you see, first of all, that TWI Development Company claims to have been the holder of the note on May 21st, 1963. This was almost a month before it actually came into being. The next thing is that it was signed by a person who purported to be the president of that company on May the 21st, 1963. And we know that this instrument could not have been created prior to June the 12th, 1963, because in its body it refers to the deed of trust which had been executed by my client. And this deed of trust, which was made back in 1961, was not recorded until June the 12th, 1963, and it refers in the appointment of substitute trustee by volume and page. Now, it behooves anybody to go then and see not only what that instrument said, but when was it filed. So that proves beyond any doubt that this instrument purporting to have been made on the 21st of June could not have been executed by a president of a corporation then in being. Now, this is not the situation where a corporation, after it has been made, can go back and ratify the acts of the developers. And that was some of the authority which Mr. Jones had cited in his briefs along the way. So you have a case of palpable fraud on its face of its instrument. And it had the burden of persuasion on each and every one of these points. Mr. Jones still had the burden of proof to show that each and every one of his muniments of title connected and went along down the line, and that he had superior title to Van Music. And for all of the things which I have enumerated this morning, I feel that he wholly failed in his burden of proof, and that a take nothing judgment is the only proper judgment insofar as Van Music is concerned. Are there any questions in whatever little time I have?
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll hear a reply from the petitioner.
Please, court. There's nothing mysterious about the deed of trust under which the foreclosure took place. It contains the provisions with which all of us are familiar, having seen them in many deeds of trust. On pages 13 and 14 of the application for writ of error, we have quoted one of the provisions from this deed of trust, which says that it's further specially agreed by the parties that in any deed or deeds given by any trustee or substitute duly appointed hereunder, any and all statements of facts or other recitals made as to, and then they enumerate these various things, non-payment and so forth, that shall be taken by any and all courts of law and equity as prima facie evidence, and that said statement or recitals do state facts and are without further question to be accepted. Now, the trial pleading of these parties, Mr. Heath and Ms. Music, which is found in the supplemental transcript in this case, that trial pleading actually alleges that the note described in the deed of trust, which was admittedly signed by Van Music, was bought by LeBoy Music in the name of TWI Development Company, a corporation wholly owned by LeBoy Music and his wife. Now that appears on page 2, supplemental transcript, and also transcript volume 2, pages 198 and 199. It also is alleged in this pleading that TWI Development Company appointed B.J. Brown as substitute trustee. Now the deed under which B.J. Brown as substitute trustee conveyed this land to the purchaser at sale, TWI Development Company, specially it contained the following recital, all of which are to be given full force and effect according to the deed of trust itself. First, the trustee named in the deed of trust was incapacitated to serve as trustee. Second, the TWI Development Company, beneficiary, owner, and holder of the deed of trust, appointed B.J. Brown to serve as substitute trustee. Third, the note secured by the deed of trust was in default. Fourth, TWI Development Company, the holder of the deed of trust, requested the substitute trustee to sell the land described in the deed of trust to satisfy the unpaid debt. Fifth, notice of sale was given by posting written notices as specified in the deed of trust. And sixth, The sale was held in accordance with the provisions of the deed of trust on July 2, 1963, and TWI Development Company was the highest bidder. Now, in view of the provisions in that deed of trust, these recitals, which I've just enumerated, and there are six of them, in the deed from B.J. Brown to TWI, establish prima facie that the foreclosure sale, that in the foreclosure sale, all requirements of the deed of trust and the law were complied with. So that certainly shifted or placed the burden upon Van Music to plead as well as prove any irregularities which he claims would invalidate the presumption that all prerequisites to the valid exercise of the power of sale have been performed. A case that's directly in point on that is Starr against Ferguson by this court in 166 Southwest 2nd, page 130, and I have particular reference to page 132. Another case, Camp Darrow versus Reed, by the Galveston Court of Appeals, writ of error refused, 131 Southwest 2nd, 297, at page 300. These decisions, I believe, state much more clearly than I could what the rule is on this subject. The burden certainly is on Van Music. Now, she has no pleading, which would possibly serve as a basis for setting aside the foreclosure, the deed of trust, the trustee's deed, or any other instrument under which the petitioner's claim. So with that situation, there could be no verdict which could serve as a basis for a judgment that Houston American take nothing or that Van Music recover. And unless there are some questions, I believe that's all I have to say.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case will be submitted on briefs and oral argument. The court will take a short recess. 10 minutes, recess.
The audience, please rise.